clones. Cops are stepping up enforcement on motorists who are not wearing their seatbelts. If you've thought to yourself, I'm not going very far, or I'm in a rush, or seatbelts are just too uncomfortable, then know this. You're putting yourself at the risk of injury or death. High visibility seatbelt enforcement is important 24 hours a day, but nighttime is especially deadly for unbuckled occupants. Keep that in mind every time you're driving or riding in a vehicle in the dark. Regardless of the vehicle type, seatbelt use is the single most effective way to stay alive. You know the saying. Now make it a household rule to live by. Click it or tick it. When you're not wearing your seatbelt, you're risking serious injury or death. It's a fact. Cops are writing tickets, so don't take the risk. Don't play the odds. Again, let me say it so it sticks. Click it or tick it.
Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, starting with social. I mean, it is game one of the NBA Finals, tipping off tomorrow night. So obviously the biggest story in the NBA is the Cavs and the Warriors Part 4. Everybody thought it would be a trilogy, but it's back. Godfather 4, the greatest team of a generation against the greatest player of a generation. I mean, literally, that is all anybody is talking about right now in the association. Excuse me, my bad. No, that's actually not the way it is. Just over 24 hours out from the start of the NBA Finals. And the biggest topic is not the NBA Finals. The biggest topic is burner accounts. Used to be all about burner phones. Burner accounts on Twitter, which is fantastic. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I'll lay it out for you. I mean, you're probably familiar with that notion of a burner account, right? If you have kids, I'm sure you're aware of the burner account notion. We found that out, right? Oh, I know, we're really active parents. We'll just monitor our kids' social accounts. Come to find out, they've got burner accounts too. I'm not saying my kids do. Hell, they might. Especially Logan, man. He's sneaky. He probably does have one. Anyway, the kids have burner accounts because they know the parents are going to monitor what they do, so they set up burner accounts. Meantime, if the kids are doing it, you have to imagine that it's happening on a much higher level, too, elsewhere. I'm not saying that's the case here. I am saying The Ringer posted a report yesterday that alleged that Philadelphia 76ers president of basketball ops, Brian Colangelo, appeared to have 5 burner accounts on Twitter. All right, that in of itself might be fine. Not that big of a deal. He wouldn't be the first team executive to have a burner account on Twitter, nor would he be the last if he has one or 5. In fact, I would bet that nearly every single team executive has got a burner account. However, tweets from the alleged 5, which were pointed out to The Ringer by an anonymous source, were not just used to monitor league business or even his own players. In fact, they weren't always so positive about his own players. Again, let me stop right there. I don't know who's responsible for the accounts. I'm just saying what was on the accounts. Furthermore, at times there were tweets that called Nerlens Noel a, quote, selfish punk. Talked about Markelle Fultz's shooting struggles and attempted to advance a theory that Jahlil Okafor's trade did not go through because he failed a physical. These same accounts also took shots at Masai Ujiri and Sam Hinkie. Oh, and questioned Joel Embiid's ego. Uh-oh! That's not good. That's not good at all. Now, that would be so crazy, so insane, and so weird that it's almost too weird to be true, right? What NBA executive, let alone a 2-time NBA Executive of the Year, would be on Twitter firing off tweets from burner accounts that crush his own players? Weird. Really weird. Story's crazy. However, that's not all. It went up another notch when Joel Embiid got involved, because my man Joel took to Twitter to respond. First, there was this. A tweet which read simply, bruh, with a picture of himself from back in the day. Then there's this tweet. directed at, it's incredible, directed at one of the alleged Colangelo burner accounts. Quote, Joel told me that at Sam Hinkie is better and smarter than you. At AlVic40117560, hashtag burner account. I mean, holy crap. Joel is the greatest. A joke tweet about Sam Hinkie directed at a Colangelo burner account. I've said it before, I'll say it again right now. Joel Embiid has got the potential to be one of the greatest ever in NBA history, but he's already the greatest ever in social media history. This guy's fearless, he's got an amazing sense of humor, and he's got the best timing ever. He then chased that with a tweet to Drake, which read, quote, I'm upset. And at this point, the story was a virus, and it was spreading quickly. CJ McCollum came sprinting in to tweet at Joe, quote, are you saying you're no longer happy in Philly? To which Joe responded, and I quote, LMAO, CJ, you just got to trust it. NBA Twitter is the best. Absolutely the best. There's nothing like it. But then Joe concluded his night with this, and I quote, fun night on Twitter, LMAO, all jokes aside, I don't believe the story. That would just be insane. You know, it would be. It'd be completely insane. Embiid also told Woj, quote, I talked to him. He said that he didn't say that. He called me just to deny the story. Gotta believe him until proven otherwise. If true, though, that would be really bad. End quote. What, if you're a president of basketball ops, had 5 burner accounts, and was anonymously killing the players? Would that be bad? Well, that'd be incredibly bad. And here's where it gets awkward. Woj also tweeted, quote, maybe there's an IT person who can prove it wasn't Brian Colangelo, but here's one of his biggest problems in disputing Ringer story. Those tweets reflected not only private team biz, but launched personal beefs, jealousies, frustrations that he has shared inside and outside 76ers. And then one more thing he followed it with. Nevertheless, Colangelo is denying he is responsible for those tweets, and many league executives seem to believe him. It's hard to fathom a GM risking his job in such a reckless manner. Many are giving him the benefit of the doubt on that level alone. It just doesn't add up. End quote. It's so true, right? It doesn't add up. It makes no sense at all. Why would a guy like that, a 2-time executive of the year, risk everything on something like that? Colangelo issued a statement using where he acknowledged that he uses one of the alleged accounts to, quote, monitor our industry and other current events, but denied posting, quote, anything whatsoever. Quote, I am not familiar with any of the other accounts that have been brought to my attention, nor do I know who is behind them and what their motives may be in using them. End quote. And then the team issued a statement as well, and on and on and on we go. Look, if the story ends here, it's weird, it's bizarre, but I'm guessing there might be another plot twist or 5. Listen, bottom line, I don't know if this guy did this or not, but if somebody else did this to him, all right? If Colangelo did not do this and somebody else did this to him, they're working awfully hard to make it look like it was him. I'm not saying he did. I'm not saying he didn't do it. I have no idea. There will be an investigation, but if somebody did do this to this guy, that's a deep, deep dive and a deep level of hatred towards one guy. I mean, my man really got on the wrong side of somebody who really has a lot of time on their hands if Colangelo is not responsible for this. And I got to say, on the other side, if you think that a story of an NBA executive who just watched his team take a giant step and be one of the best stories in the NBA, getting caught with 5 burner accounts sounds too ridiculous to be true, it does. But then again, if you think something like that couldn't happen, take a look around. It's 2018. There are a lot of ridiculous things, too ridiculous to be true, that are happening, and only in basketball. I don't know, like Nick Young is in the finals. J.R. Smith threw a bowl of soup at a coach. The Clippers and Rockets had a secret Staples tunnel fight. And remember Eric Bledsoe and the hair salon? That was this season, too. Kendrick Perkins and Drake nearly giving each other the hands? That was a few weeks back. I'm telling you, if the NBA had a one shining moment montage, it would last 90 minutes, and it would blow right by any of the best movies you've ever seen. Casablanca, Citizen Kane. And it wouldn't even need to include any on-court action. I'm telling you, I've got no idea if Colangelo is responsible for these burner accounts or not, but I can't wait to find out. Wednesday's episode of the Daily Jungle is brought to you by Fan Exchange. Head on over to fanexchange.com for a safe, easy, and reliable experience. Tickets purchased on Fan Exchange are always guaranteed. You don't have to sweat getting to the gate and worrying about getting in. So, whether it's March Madness, or Major League Baseball, or WrestleMania, or Coachella, or a Broadway musical, Fan Exchange will get you closer to the action. You can find the very best seats at the very best prices at fanexchange.com. Just use the promo code ROME. The promo code ROME will get you 50% off service fees on your next purchase. Time to buy tickets. Do yourself a favor. Check out Fan Exchange first. We have tickets. Check it out now. Fan Exchange. We are joined right now by Chris Mara. Chris, it is so good to have you on the show. Good morning. How are you?
Thanks, Jim, for having me. I appreciate it.
Chris, great to have you. Now, you, my friend, are in rarefied air, a position that very few have been in when it comes to horse racing. We're about a week and a half out from the Belmont. How would you describe your mood right now? For instance, is it pure excitement? Is it nerves? Or is it something else?
You know, it's a little bit of nerves. It's also a lot of curiosity and what the field is actually going to look like. You know, the horse worked out yesterday morning and looked terrific, so I'm pretty confident in all that. There's not a lot I can do about it, I can tell you that, because I don't really have much say in what's going on with the horse. I just have to make sure the check clears.
Hey, Chris, that's really funny. I mean, you and I are having a conversation where I know exactly what you're talking about. As the owners, I think people have no idea how little control we have. And people like you and I and everybody in the business, don't we just wake up every single day and think, no news is good news. As long as I don't get that telephone call, I'm going to assume everything's all right and that's a good day.
That's absolutely correct. You know, my first year in this with Starlight, you know, we had a horse, Intense Holiday, who ended up going to the Derby, and I'll never forget those 2 weeks before that. You know, we were doing draft preparations here, and I wake up in the middle of the night just waiting for either a phone call or a text or an email saying, oh, the horse is not doing well, blah, 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 and it was really nerve-wracking.
It's so true. Chris Mara, my guest, because they don't call to tell you everything's great. They only call if there's a problem. So we all kind of learn that as long as they don't call, that's a good thing. You know, everybody, and I want to talk to you about Justify, but everybody involved in horse racing has got a story about the moment they were hooked by the sport. What's yours?
I was 10 years old, and mom and dad took me to Belmont Park Saturday before a giant home game at Yankee Stadium, which I believe we got blown out in. But back then that happened a lot, and I was kind of hooked then. And then I just followed the sport right through, you know, high school and college. And, you know, I parked cars at Yonkers Raceway when I was younger. Was fortunate enough to go see Seattle Slough in 77, win the Triple Crown, and then Affirmed the year after. And then 3 years ago, American Pharoah. So I was just hooked on the sport right from the beginning.
You know, it's really interesting, Chris, because you've been around the game your entire life. You've been in professional sports most of your life. But while you were a fan of the sport, you weren't really, really all in as an owner until just a few years ago when you met Jack Wolf of Starlight Partners. What made you finally decide to get more involved and take that big plunge?
Well, we had just come off a Super Bowl win. My daughter, Rooney, had just been nominated for an Academy Award. And I felt pretty lucky. And so I said to my wife, you know, this might be the time where I start to get involved in I'd been involved in some other ownership groups prior to this, but nothing to this level. This is a very, you know, expensive hobby, as I call it. And so we took the plunge, and it's been 7 years, and they've been all great years. It's not like they're all profitable or anything, but we have so much fun doing it. And this year, it's really paid off.
No, it's true, right? When it's good, it's great. When it's not, it's not. And it's a very, very expensive hobby. In fact, that's how I got in. Chris, my wife said, you need a hobby. You need a hobby. And she talked me into getting into this. And then finally, a few years later, she's like, I didn't say that expensive a hobby, but you needed a hobby. You know, you mentioned Jack Wolf. What's interesting to me is when you start to talk to him, he didn't say to you, we'd love to have you. Come on in. What he said to you was, why? What do you have to bring to the group? What was your response to that?
Yeah. That's exactly right. This isn't a group for everyone, but yeah, I sat down and talked to Jack, and he asked me what I would bring to the group. I said, well, we just won a Super Bowl, and my daughter's been very successful. I feel pretty lucky, so maybe I'll bring a little luck to the group. And So he sat there and had a Tito's or two with me and said, "You're in." And then I went with Donna Brothers, who's part of our racing group, and went to the sales at Saratoga. And from that point on, I've been involved.
Chris, is that your poison of choice at the track, Tito's?
Yes, it is.
Not bad. Not bad at all. Chris Mira joining us. You've got it. You got to take some. You need something to take the edge off at the track. You know, you've said that you've been around the sport long enough that you can now tell a good horse from a bad horse. When you first saw Justify, what did you think of him?
Well, we got involved in this right after Justify had won his maiden race back in February. And then, like about a week later, you know, the ownership group bought a piece of both Justify and Audible, who finished third in the Derby. And then Justify happened to run his second race on my birthday, March 11th. And I sat there and kind of in awe and watched him win by 9 or 10 lengths and said, "Wow, we might have something here." So that's kind of when I figured it out.
We're talking to Chris Mira. You know, you've been a part of the 4 Super Bowl wins that I talked about with the Giants. The last two came in dramatic fashion, especially. You had the David Tyree catch, the Plaxico Burress catch. But is there any way to compare? And people always want you to do this. They're totally different. But how do you compare the emotions of winning a Super Bowl with the emotion of seeing Justify coming down the stretch in the Derby, knowing you're going to win that race?
Well, you know, my situation is a lot different. Obviously, you know, being an owner of the team and an employee is part of the process of putting the team together. You know, there's certainly a lot of satisfaction when the team wins a Super Bowl or is successful, you know, on a day-to-day basis. And on the other hand, there's also a sense of disappointment when we're, you know, as lousy as we were last year. You take share of that responsibility. You know, with the horse racing, it's just great to be in a winner's circle. You know, I have absolutely no say in what the day-to-day business of it is. I leave that totally up to Hall of Fame trainer and jockey and Mike Smith. But the feeling, it's very exhilarating. I mean, especially with the Kentucky Derby. You know, I've been going to the Derby for a long time now and just never pictured myself in the winner's circle. Between that and the Preakness, it's been a great ride, and hopefully we got one more left in us.
Yeah, you know, Chris, I'll ask you about the Belmont in 1 second, but you mentioned Mike Smith. He's a guy that I've got immense respect for. He won us a couple of Breeders' Cup races. He had a number of other grade one wins for us with Shared Belief. I mean, I love the guy. Can you talk about the relationship he has with your horse and how the two of them together have handled everything so far?
Well, all I can tell you is they look great together. Those two races were pretty incredible. To think that this horse, you know, broke his maiden, you know, February 18th, and now is running for the Triple Crown. I think people in the business, you know, yourself included. I mean, this is a historic thing, and I think it'll all come out maybe next week, right before the race starts, when people kind of sit down, and I don't think the buzz is that high right now. I mean, we just had a Triple Crown winner 3 years ago, but I think by next week the buzz will get a little bit bigger.
Chris, I don't think people outside the business understand how astonishing that it is that you're even in this position, not only for a horse. I mean, these are three such demanding races. To even run in all three, regardless of where you finish, is a huge ask. To win all three is just astonishing to me, and especially for a horse that didn't even run as a two-year-old. It's amazing that Justify's in this position. So now you go to Belmont Park. You've got a chance to win the Triple Crown. Knowing what that track means to you in terms of your connection to the sport, what's it feel like for you to be in this position even?
Well, it feels great. I've never been in the position before, but, you know, I've certainly been a part of all those Super Bowls, so I'm a little used to that type of the spotlight, at least, and having those nerves flowing in me. But this will be a great day. It's great for horse racing. It's great for the New York Racing Association to have, you know, 90,000 people show up. You know, it kind of makes our year as far as that goes. I just hope it's a great show.
So finally, Chris, how do you feel about him at a mile and a half on Big Sandy? Once again, a really big ask.
Well, it's a big ask, but, you know, the funny thing is this horse has basically won his last two races in 15 inches of rain between the Derby and the Preakness. And I don't even know if we've seen the best of the horse yet, because it really hasn't run on a dry track like that until it's, you know, back in its maiden voyage, because everything else has been on a wet track.
Boy, he showed up big at the Preakness. Isn't it funny, Chris? The best ones, they don't care, I don't think. They can run on anything, over anything, through anything. The best ones just go.
That's exactly right. It's the same as a really good football player, a good wide receiver, good running back. They can play in any conditions.
And non-race fans love this. Before I let you go, what's a good comparison? When you look at Justify, is there an NFLer that horse reminds you of?
Well, I'm hoping it's Saquon Barkley, our first-round pick.
There you go. If you want to take years off your look and take the years off before breakfast, I've got something for you. Experience Control GX from Just for Men, the first shampoo with a brain. So what makes it so smart? It reduces gray the same way it grows in, gradually. The more you shampoo with Control GX, the less gray you have. Sounds too good to be true, but this stuff really, really works. Start getting rid of the gray today. Just use it until you like what you see. Now, how smart is that? Smart enough to be voted Men's Hair Care Product of the Year. Gradually reduce gray with the first shampoo with a brain. Find Control GX in the shave aisle. That's Control GX. I could do an entire program, all 3 hours, literally every single day, just talking about social media and the way guys use it. The way guys get abused, the way guys abuse it, the way guys get played, the way people play other people, the way people get use. I could do an entire show on social media alone. And not one show, an entire show every single day. But that's not what I want to do. But this next story is also Twitter related. And it involves Cleveland Brown Damarius Randall. Now, I want you to check this. This guy tweeted this. And to quote my 13-year-old son, no, actually. Whenever I call Logan on something or Logan, if I say something and Logan doesn't believe it, he'll go, no, actually. Yeah, that guy, Rogan Loam. He'll go, no, actually. Like, no, actually. Like, we went to a basketball game once, and one of the alumni guys at UC Santa Barbara was all hugging up on Logan. I said, Logan, man, that guy loves you. He goes, no, actually, Dad, I think he does. No, so this guy, Damarius Randall, tweeted this. No, actually, he did. Quote, if the Cleveland Cavaliers win the 2018 NBA Finals, I'll buy everyone who retweets this a jersey. So you've got a Brown saying that if the Cavaliers win, every retweet gets a gamer. On the surface, it looks like an amazing gesture from a guy who arrived in C-Town in an off-season trade with the Packers. I mean, I see you working. You want to talk about winning over your new fans. There's no better way to do it than with a generous gift. If they win, we win. Everybody wins. I love that. Damarius is all in on Cleveland and Believeland. But wait, come to find out, that's not what this is about. That's not what he's doing. What this is Damarius is a huge Warriors fan. And he made that tweet from the standpoint of, oh yeah, right. The Cavaliers are going to win. Yeah, right. Yeah, I'll tell you what, if the Cavaliers win, I'll buy everybody a jersey. But that's not going to happen, and I'm not going to have to do jack. That's where that guy's coming from. This is not about him being a great guy. This is not about him rolling into Cleveland with a truckload of gamers for everybody to celebrate the win. No, this is about this guy backing up a truckload of salt with him. And you know what? I like that even better. That's even better. Him saying, if they do, I'll buy everybody a jersey, is even better than him saying, if they do, I'll buy everybody a jersey. Because what he's saying is, they're not going to. It'll never happen. And if they do, I'll buy y'all gamers. I mean, everybody knows about the goofy wagers, the corny wagers between mayors of cities or between teammates who went to rival schools. Like, if my school beats yours, you have to rock my jersey for an entire week. Except in this case, that bet is between Damarius Randall and essentially all of Ohio, especially since, and one of you can help me with this, the last I saw, those retweets were up to 719,000. 719,000 retweets. Now it's 753. So now he's over 750,000 retweets. This means if C-Town shocks the world and they pull off that upset, my man is headed to a local sporting goods store and ordering close to 1 million jerseys by the time he's said and done. And at roughly $100 a pop, that's going to add up to roughly $100 million. 100 mil. Now, like Hawk, I am no mathematician.
The simple maths.
But that's more than his salary. That's more than Demaryius' salary by a factor of, let me check, a ton. And don't get me wrong. This guy's not casually rooting for the Warriors. My man's all in. But that doesn't mean that he's not happy for Cleveland. In fact, he's thrilled. Check out this tweet. Quote, you want to talk about backing up a truck of salt. Quote, I'm glad the Cavs made it to the finals so I can watch Curry light that bitch up in game 3 and 4. Uh-oh! He's going to be courtside to see it. My man, that is incredible. Straight freaking fire. I am so glad the Cavaliers made it to the finals. Not because it's great for the city. Not because it's great for the fans. Not because we're witnessing the best player of a generation doing an amazing thing in LeBron. But because I won't have to travel that far to see my team beat Cleveland. I mean, what a tweet. That's amazing. Now, some might say it's stupid and it's reckless to come rolling into a new city and immediately start trolling their fans, especially when that city is Cleveland and they take their sports very seriously, especially when you haven't played a single game or even a single snap for that team, because you're going to take fire back. Except Randall, man, he couldn't care less. My man is going in. He's going in, and it's awesome. Almost as awesome as his response to somebody tweeting at him. Quote, that's quite the way to ingratiate yourself to a new fan base. And he fired right back. Quote, they will love me when they see me play free safety. I'm telling you, this dude's a legend. And if you're a Browns fan, and you saw that, and now you hate Randall because of these tweets, then you gotta check yourself. You're gonna get all bitter about this guy because he roots for a different basketball team. He's rooting for the Warriors, not the Bengals, not the Steelers, not the Ravens. This guy's having a little bit of fun. You should too. Lighten up. I mean, why is everything so personal now? Why is it that when it comes to your team and your town, everything is a reason to go? I'm not saying you shouldn't be proud. I'm not saying you shouldn't defend your town and your team. But why is everything a reason to go now? Besides, if this guy's wrong, you can talk all the junk you want and you get a free gamer. So what are you so uptight about? Worst thing to happen to y'all. Are you kidding? He's one of the best. And especially if the guy is as good as he says he is on Sundays. So if you think he's joking about the jersey bet, he's also not. At least he says he's not, because somebody retweeted his original offer with the comment of, quote, 0% he delivers. Randall again fired right back with a retweet and said 100% chance. So here's where I come out. I respect the tweet, and even more respect if you somehow follow through on that tweet, especially since it might cost you 75 to 100 mil. Hope that's worth it. Luckily for him, he's never going to have to find out. I love it. C-Town, man, don't be so sensitive. Have a little fun with it. Hey, look, if the guy's right, no harm, no foul, see you on Sundays. If the guy's wrong, you get a free gamer. And he's got to scratch a check for 75 mil. And the internet's in ink. I love it. Bob Myers. Bob, it is so good to have you back. How are you, Bob?
I'm having some San Quentin shirts made. I'm gonna have Raymond send you one.
Oh, that'd
San
be great.
Quentin Warriors. So, as a supporter of the cause.
I am a great supporter of that cause, and I would love to have that. So whatever Raymond makes up and sends out here, I'll take it. How are things, Bob? You're on the eve. You're 24 hours away from tipping off game one of the finals. How is your life? How are you feeling?
I'm good, man. This is the shortest time we've had between Western Conference finals and finals. So, I mean, I think we knew if we won, we'd be playing Cleveland, but we were still preparing for Houston on Monday night. So we got back about 3 or 4 in the morning after that game. Didn't do anything yesterday. The coaches watched film. And then today we just met, and the team's practicing right now at our arena. But it's a quick turnaround. So fortunately, you know, LeBron is he's no surprise. We've seen him a lot. But they have a different team and not a lot of prep time. But the Houston series, that was a monster. I mean, that was coming off that. I remember how we celebrated beating San Antonio last year, which was a much different series. But our players – you know, there's a true appreciation for what they've done. That Houston series was probably one of the toughest ones we've ever faced in the last 4 years.
Bob Myers, my guest. You know, Bob, when you look at that and you look at the Western Conference Finals, I mean, do you come out of that thinking that you're better because of it, that you were pushed like that and that's a good thing? Or is there maybe some frustration that maybe it could have ended earlier and you could have gotten some more rest?
Yeah, I mean, look. What we felt like was in the game, the turning point in that series was game four. And however you want to characterize it, we were up 10 going into the fourth at home. That's a game we win 90% of the time. And credit Houston again, they beat us. That's where it felt like in the playoffs, you cannot, I don't want to use the term giveaway, but you can't let go of a game at home. Because when you do, you force yourself in a win that you view that as a winnable game, maybe a game we should have won. Now you've got to beat a very good team 5 times because you count that one as a game you probably should have won. So that was tough coming off that and then losing game 5 and being backs up against it. But yeah, I mean, Kevin, after the game, Durant, I was sitting with him on the plane and he said, you know, I feel more part of the team now than I ever have, meaning we hadn't been through a ton of adversity in the last year of the playoffs. We went through some adversity this regular season, but last year in the playoffs, yeah, it was great, and it was smooth, and it was a little bit of like a honeymoon year having Kevin. But to face adversity, that's when you really get to know your teammates, your organization, when you go through a situation like we did, you know, getting that close to being knocked out by Houston, you build kind of these bonds. And so, yeah, we're better for it, probably more tired for it. But, yeah, I mean, those things strengthen your team if you get through them.
We're talking to Bob Myers. You know, Bob, when you and I spoke earlier in the playoffs, you mentioned the conversations that you had with Draymond Green and some of the other players during the regular season about needing the stakes to be high in order to be fully committed. So knowing that, I'm curious, what's going through your head when the team came out and fell behind by double digits in both Game 6 and Game 7? Was there any part of you thinking, all right, fellas, the stakes are pretty high right now. You don't need to make them any higher?
Yeah, I mean, that's the hard part with our team, Jim. And we're human beings. Everybody thinks that our team just walks out there and wins. I mean, they're people, and like you and me, they show up for work. You've been doing what you've been doing a long time. Yeah, I mean, you probably don't have the same energy you had the first year you had your own show. You probably have days where it's a job. You're at the top. People are coming after you. So it's a little bit different when you're on the ascent than when you're sitting there at the top and looking around. So it's tough. I mean, you want our team. It's a little bit like the last two games of that series. It was almost like we were a boxer that had the belt that needed to be knocked around a little bit in the first round to wake up. I mean, we had to almost take a punch to get in the fight. That's not what you want to do. I mean, the idea from the coaching staff and the players, we talked before both those games about coming out and being ready and not getting behind and take care of the basketball. And for whatever reason, I mean, a lot of it's the Rockets, but we didn't do it. And now you're down 10 and a half, 2 games back-to-back against a very good team. And you put yourself in this position where you have to play great in the second half. Everybody talks about our third quarters. Well, that's oftentimes in response to a lackluster first half. So nobody's around here. I wasn't sitting. If you were at the game and I walked into you and you'd say, what's going on? I'd say, Jim, I don't know. I wouldn't tell you, yeah, we got this. We'll have a great third quarter and we'll win the game. It's a dangerous game to play. We've gotten away with it. But I don't think anybody likes that pattern. So I was worried. I was worried. But, you know, you look around the locker room. I was at halftime of the game. And the players, they're still connected. And that's important because where you lose these games when you're down is in the huddle where somebody points a finger. And Steph had a good comment after it where there was a moment where it could have gone sideways, and it didn't. It was when Draymond threw that cross-court pass, and Harden picked it off and dunked it. And he was getting into it with Kevin a little bit, which is natural in the course of a game seven on the road. And the fact that they kind of came together and said, let's play the next play, move on, that's over with. And Steph even said, those are the times where you could splinter as a team. Or even at a halftime, when the doors are shut and some player goes to another player and that player hangs on to that emotion and you come out and you just let go of that rope. But we were calm. We were upset. And then that, I think, allowed the team to come out and do what they did in the second half.
We're talking to Bob Myers. To me, Bob, that's everything right there. I mean, it would have been so easy for the team, any team, to completely implode or fold after that first quarter of Game 7 because nothing was going right. So what's it say about Steve Kerr and the players that that didn't happen, and what keeps them together in a moment like that?
Yeah, I mean, you referenced Steve. Steve's resume, as far as having been there, is probably the best in the league, where you can look at a coach who's won five championships as a player who played with Michael Jordan and Tim Duncan and has been in these moments, in these pressure-filled moments, made pressure-filled shots in big games in the finals. So you can't help as a human being to look at your leader and say, am I going to get behind this guy? And when you have a Steve Kerr in the locker room or pregame or postgame, these players know who has done it and who hasn't. And they look at Steve Kerr, and they can. When he says something, he's been there. He's been in their shoes. I can't sit up there and say anything about what it's like to play in a Game 7 on the road, but he can. And he does it in a humble way. He doesn't pound his chest and say, hey, when I was with the Bulls, I made a shot, so you need to do that. He doesn't do any of that stuff. It's just more about, guys, we're capable. And then it comes with, when we won the first title, Steve said something to me. He said, the hardest thing to do is to win the first one because the truth is you don't know if you're capable. As a human being, you just don't know because it's so hard, so much harder than people think to win any. But the first one, there's a doubt. There's a doubt, if we're being honest with ourselves. There's a doubt in the back of our minds, whether it's me or the coach, him as a coach, even though he'd done it as a player, our players that hadn't won it. Can I do this? They've seen all the greats win championships, but they've never won it. But when you've won it, you have that confidence inside of you. When you talk about our locker room, you look around that locker room, there's a lot of guys that have not just won one, but won a couple. And if you haven't won them, and we just signed a player, he may not admit it, but he's kind of looking over at Draymond Green going, this guy knows. He knows the way. He's done this before. He's played in three finals. That, Jim, is the difference sometimes, that confidence of I've been there, I know the way. And we've got a good amount of those guys now. And that in the moments that are tight, that kind of carries.
Bob Myers, the Golden State Warriors, joining us. You know, Bob, I appreciate those thoughts very much. You look at you and Steve Kerr, and you have a very close relationship. You have a very unique relationship. There's a mutual bond and respect there. Does he strike you as somebody that wants to keep doing this and grinding it out? Or maybe do you have to check his pulse year to year? Like, where's his head and his heart in this right now? Because he's had so much success, and there is a price to be paid. And, you know, Steve Kerr can do literally anything he wants.
We were driving to Napa. We had some retreat on our business side, and Steve and I were driving up together, and I asked him that question. I said, hey, man, how long do you want to do this? And he kind of looked at me, and he said, well, he kind of was befuddled. He's like, what do you mean, how long do you want to do it? And I said, I'm just curious, you know? I mean, it's a hard job. And his response was, forever. I mean, I love this. And I kind of laughed. I said, you know, you haven't really coached in the NBA yet. Because I said, this isn't reality, what we're doing.
Right.
So the reality is when we're 20 and 21 year, we don't have any player, you know, and it's a grind. And he said, yeah, you're right. Good point. But I think he'll be excited about that challenge too. Steve Kerr was, I think he was meant to coach. You're right. He could do anything he wants. He was a great player. He was a good GM. He was a lead broadcaster. He could host a radio. He could do anything. He's that smart. He's that accomplished. But I do think, oftentimes in our life, it takes till you're 40 or 50 or even longer to find the thing that you feel most comfortable in your own skin. And I would tell you, I bet he's even more comfortable doing this than he was playing, and he would probably admit that. He was kind of born for this. I hate kind of saying that, but I think it's true with Steve. This is his calling, and I think he'll do it, you know, as long as he can and until he tires of it. But I don't – it is tough, though. You're right to acknowledge. I mean, you've had a lot of coaches, I'm sure. You've interacted with them. It's a high stakes deal. The media, the fans, the players, the organization, the pressure. A lot of people listening might say, "Oh, big deal. Coaches make a lot of money." They do, they do make a lot of money. That part, you're right, that box gets checked. But as far as the pressure, I mean, you probably got a ton of press conferences you've seen, of whether it's a football, basketball, baseball coach, or manager. These guys are under it. So that's the challenge for a guy like Steve Kerr and any professional coach, is how do you balance life and coaching? Because it can consume you. But I do think he does a great job. He's gone through some things in his life he's seen the highest highs and the lowest lows. I think that helps to maintain kind of some sanity. But I think he'll do it for a long, long time. I hope he does. I mean, he's a great partner for me.
You bet. Bob Myers, my guest. Bob, before I let you go, you mentioned the Cavaliers and LeBron. I mean, when you look at the Cavaliers, obviously, they're a very different Cavs team than the one you faced the previous 3 years, but it's still LeBron. And I know you've been focused on your own team and the road through the West, but what do you make of what LeBron has done in this postseason?
When we played him, Jim, oh, man, 4 years, whatever it was, 14, 15, somebody from the East called me, a GM, or somebody said, you don't really understand who LeBron is till you play him in a playoff series. And I said, okay, whatever. I know how good he is. But even though we beat him in six games, you check his line in 2014-15, his numbers and what he did, and Love got hurt and Kyrie got hurt, and you do find out the depth of how great he is. But my take on this one, Jim, is, as we do this for the fourth time against the team led by him, is I look at it like I grew up watching, you know, Michael Jordan in his prime, and I think what I am trying to do this time around is I'm appreciating having a front row seat. This however these things turn out, in 20 years somebody's going to talk about how great he was. They're going to talk about whatever they do with our team, and I'll get to say I saw all that up close. And that to me is the equivalent of saying I was there when Michael Jordan was playing in those series against the Bulls, or I was at those games with Magic and Larry. I do believe that there'll be some relevance to these series because he was in them for some of the things our team has done, and that's pretty cool. And I'm trying to not wait 10, 15 years down the line to look back. I'm trying to sit here and watch the game tomorrow night and just appreciate him and appreciate the team, the Cavs, the organization, and our own organization, and say this is high-level stuff that's happening. Don't just think this is the norm. And so he is definitely not a normal one. It's going to be a fun series. It's going to be a fun series.
You know, Bob, you've always been like that. One final thought. You want to appreciate what's in front of you, and you understand how life is short and how every opportunity is precious. But if we go 10, 15, 20 years out and the conversation turns to your Golden State Warriors team, what do you think that conversation is going to sound like? What do you hope it sounds like?
That's a great question. I don't know what it's going to sound like. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, it probably depends on what we do in the next couple of years. But I hope it sounds like the best thing I hear when I'm out and about is I never watched the NBA until I started watching your guys' team. And that comment, Jim, can come from the 80-year-old grandma on the corner that really did never watch the NBA. The comments about, hey, you know, when I was in the hospital, your team kind of got me through. You know, I loved watching the Warriors games, or I remember that team, and they got me through some tough times. It's really, Steve Kerr told me, because it's my job too. I mean, I'm not looking for empathy, but I asked Steve one time. I said, "What is the best part of what we do?" And he said, "It's what you give back to a community. That is the joy from this occupation. It's the joy you give to your fans." And that's worth a lot. How much of us can work in a place where you can touch the lives of people in a pretty profound way? I mean, people, my hope is in 20 years, they go, I remember where I was when you guys did X. That's pretty cool to say, wow. You know, it's all said and done for us, Jim, we'll probably remember 20 things in our life. We'll remember our weddings, our kids. And in our society, you too, you're going to remember I was at that game 7, or I was at that boxing match, or I was at that baseball game. This stuff stays with us. And so that's the part that I hope it embeds on people. And I hope it's a positive thing that they remember the high character of guys like Steph Curry, Steve Kerr, Draymond, Clay, Durant, Iguodala. I mean, I hope they remember who the people are, not just the team, but the people that made up the team.
Bob Myers, not only a San Quentin Hoops legend, but a jungle legend as well. Bob, you know, I appreciate the relationship so much, and I always look forward to these conversations, and especially the fact that you avail yourself throughout the postseason for us and this program. Bob, thank you so much. Good luck. Can't wait for this thing to tip off.
Jim, what's the football guy that left the tickets for Elvis? Who was that? That was
Jerry Glanville.
Yeah, should I just leave a ticket for Jim Rome, like at will call for all these games, and just if you show up, you show up? You want me to do that for you?
How about two for every single game?
Hey, seriously, if you want to come, let me know.
We go to South Carolina. Diane is in South Carolina. Diane, good morning. Nice to have you.
Well, I appreciate getting on. I just had called because I'm retired and I'm up in age and I need more things to get on my mind. And I thought, well, I'm gonna start. I've always watched some football, but I need to put my mind on something and not. Well, anyway, to help not getting down, and I started watching all sorts of sports. I watched the National Hockey League this week, and Washington played Vegas, and I read a little about hockey, but not much, and I thought, I'm going to pull for Vegas, because I read that article about them, and they won. But anyway, so I was surprised how I began to understand the game as I watched it, which I've never watched a hockey game. And then I've watched college sports. I can't afford what Dish offers, the lowest package. That's what I have. And I thought, well, I don't get any ESPNs. And I started looking, and I found your show. And I just watch it every day, and I'm learning an awful lot just by listening to you. And so I had wondered what I ought to start getting a sports magazine. I know I've heard of Sports Illustrated.
All right, Diane, let me jump in, Diane. First of all, you are such a dear, Diane. Let me help you with this. Hawk, put her on hold so you can hear this, Diane. I need, because I'm running out of time, Diane, so I want to put you on hold. First of all, thank you very much for finding the show. I think that's great. She said, I'm retired, and I don't want to get down, so I started watching sports to take my mind off things, and I found hockey, and I found the Capitals, and I found Vegas, and I'm starting to figure out that sport, and I'm surprised by how much I like that. And then she said, do you know, I don't have the full package with Dish, so I can't afford ESPN, but I found your show. Good news is, Diane, you're not missing anything at all by not being able to afford that. Now, when you talk about magazines, you know a lot more than I thought. It's funny when you said, so can I get a magazine? Can I read a magazine? Can I learn by reading a magazine? The thing about magazines is that's a tough business. I only subscribe, believe it or not, and I'm in this business, and it's my job to scour as much information as possible. Diane, there are only two magazines that I have delivered to my home that are sports magazines. The first one you mentioned, Sports Illustrated, which is still a great magazine with tremendous writing and some of the most impressive, talented people in our business. Some of the best reporting in our business is still done for that magazine. So that's a very good way to go. I would recommend Sports Illustrated. And the second magazine that I subscribe to, and it's only because I can't figure out how to kill it, and it just keeps coming, ESPN. And that comes from my mailbox and goes right into my garbage can.
Garbage!
So, yeah, Sports Illustrated is a great way to go. Diane, CBS. Diane, so nice to meet you. Clones, get your acts together, man. You handle that. You handle that responsibly and respectfully. We are joined by Kyle Williams. Kyle, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Good, Jim. How's it going?
Great, Kyle. It's great to visit with you. Thanks so much. Let me first ask you, back in March, you signed that new contract with the Bills. They made it very clear they wanted you back. I'm curious about your process. Were you at all curious to see what else was out there, or was there no doubt in your mind that you were where you wanted to be?
Well, you know, I think having been somewhere so long and, you know, having grown such a great admiration for our community and our fan base and our team, and really for Sean and Brandon, you know, I really felt like we were headed in a good direction. I have a lot of respect for those guys and, you know, really wanted to see the process through here. Obviously, I had other opportunities, but, you know, they never really materialized, and I think I ended up right where I'm supposed to be.
Kyle Williams joining us. I thought you had a great line after you signed that deal. Kyle, you said, quote, when it comes down to it, as eloquently as I can put it, I haven't exhausted myself in pursuit of what my dream is for playing this game, playing for this organization, and chasing being a champion, end quote. I mean, I really love that phrase. I haven't exhausted myself in pursuit of what my dream is. I mean, how would you describe that dream and what you've been chasing your entire life?
Well, you know, it's just, you have a vision for what you want to accomplish and who you want to be and the type of player you want to be. And at this point, I think obviously, being 13 years into it, what you would say, quote unquote, are my prime years may or may not be behind me. I can still be a good player, which I think I am, and I can continue to build. But at this point, it's, hey, you know what? I want to be a champion. And I also want to pass on a legacy of what work looks like real work. Hey, what does it mean to come out here and grind? And I want to pass that on to my friends and my teammates and continue to help them get better, and they can pass it on down the line, and all of that in pursuit of what, the ultimate goal is in this game, and that's being a Super Bowl champion.
I love that. Kyle Williams joining us. What about playing until you've exhausted your pursuit? I mean, like, playing in the NFL is exhausting. Playing your position the way you do and at the level you have, it'd be easy to be exhausted and beat up at the end of the year. So in terms of that part of the process, in the offseason, do you check in with yourself at the start of each offseason to see if you've exhausted yourself? And if so, how do you know that you're good to keep chasing that dream?
I just think that if there's a flicker for me, there's going to be a flame. And I love to play. I love being in the locker room, being with teammates, old teammates, new teammates, all the way around. And like I said, if there's a little bit of glimmer that I want to do it, I'm going to pursue it. This is such a short season of life, even when you get to do it for a long time, that, I think you owe it to yourself to give it its full effort and its full due. And by that is, going out and preparing and working and saying, hey, I'm going to give it my best shot again. And then I'll reevaluate at the end of the year and see how I feel.
Bills defensive tackle Kyle Williams, my guest. You took a new step, obviously, last year in that dream when you helped lead the team to its first playoff trip in nearly two decades. Now, I know that reaching the playoffs is not the ultimate goal, but when you look back on the experience, what sticks out to you the most?
Well, I think the main thing for me, and I voiced this in a couple of different interviews and things like that, is I think outside of us obviously making the playoffs, which is great for our organization and our teammates and all that, is when it happened, the country really got an opportunity to see what the community of Buffalo and the Buffalo Bills fans were, with all the reactions, the tears, the cheering, the jumping up and down, young, old, everywhere in between, from bars to living rooms. I thought that was the greatest thing that came out of that playoff berth, was an opportunity for the country, for the Buffalo Bills fan base, to be showcased to them.
Very clear how much you love that community, and the community loves you back. Now that you've had that experience and you can build on it, does it feel like you enter this season as a different team with even bigger expectations?
I try not to put any kind of expectations or goals, whether it be on myself or on our team. My only thing that I will harp on continually is, hey, you get an opportunity, and we're going to do our best today. Whatever that means, we're going to go out there, and we're going to work, and we're going to get better today at the smallest things. Is it running to the football? Is it hand placement? Is it communication? We're going to work on the smallest things today, and we're going to let that play out. We're going to work. We're going to give a playoff caliber effort every day, and we're going to do it from now, May 29th, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, all the way through into January. And then when we get through New Year's Day or whatever it is with our last game, then we'll look up and see where we are.
We're talking to Kyle Williams. Kyle, you mentioned Sean at the top of the interview. That, of course, is your head coach, Sean McDermott. He raved about not only what you mean on the field, but what you mean in that locker room and how you helped him connect his message to the team. What was that first year under McDermott like for you?
It was good. I think that it's rare this day and age when you bring a coach in and he describes to you the vision of what he wants his team to look like, the way he wants his team to prepare day in and day out, and the way he wants his team to compete on Sundays, and everything that he says rings a bell with you. You really see things the same way. You believe it the same way. You believe that hard work and grit will overcome most everything. And I think that was really what our team showcased last year. Everybody wanted to call it the Band of Misfits, whatever you wanted to call it. We had a lot of guys who competed their tail off and they stuck together. and good things happen.
Listen, Cal, I know you're never going to make it about you, but I just want to reiterate that you are beloved in Buffalo, and now you're closing in on the top 10 in team history for the most games played in a Bills uniform. I mean, that's an amazing accomplishment for anybody, but especially for somebody who is a fifth-round draft pick. What do you remember about when you first joined that team, and then what was your mindset and approach back then?
Well, you know, you're sitting there and you're trying to figure out, hey, where am I going to go live? I had a young wife at the time. You know, we're coming up on, I think we're about to have a baby, you know, so we're trying to figure out where we're going to live and where we're going to go. And for me, my mindset, I'm coming to Buffalo or wherever I may have ended up, was the only thing that I thought that I was entitled to was an opportunity to compete. And that's all I wanted. And that's really, in my mind, that's all that I needed. And I knew that the league that I'd played in, the school that I'd played in, I'd played against a lot of these guys in the past, and I knew that my game would match up, and I knew that hard work would carry me over the top and make sure that I was able to stick and get the job done, you know, and then here we are, you know, 13 years later.
Yeah, here we are. I mean, if I had told Kyle Williams in 2006 that he'd be preparing for his 13th season and would be an all-time Bills legend, what would that Kyle Williams have said? Would he have believed it?
Well, I would have probably told you the same thing I would tell any of these guys now. You know, anything, you can do anything, but the only thing that's ahead of me right now is a lot of work, and anything is possible from there. You know, if you go out and you give it all you got, you know, every day at practice, every day during the game, you know, you never know what your limitations are unless you push them. And, you know, obviously we've been very blessed and very lucky to be a part of this organization, and it's been a great time. I'm glad to be here. And, you know, one thing that I've always heard, you know, that the minutes are long, but the years are short. And that's definitely true when it comes to this game of football.
I think that's definitely true when it comes to life. That's a great point. Listen, one more thought. I mean, you don't stay in the game as long as you have and play it at the level that you have without having a burning desire to be great and a drive to keep learning and keep getting better. I mean, it'd be a lot easier just to roll out of the bed every single morning, Kyle, and say, I'm Kyle Williams. I'm a 5-time Pro Bowler. I'm good enough as it is. So what are the things that motivate you and excite you to improve each day at this juncture of your career?
Well, I think for me is can my habits – better help someone improve their game? Can my view of the game, the way that I see things, if I can teach that to someone else, will it help a guy that's on the roster bubble or a guy that's going into a contract year? Is it going to help them up their game? Are all of these things going to benefit our football team, number one? You know, if I can pass along my knowledge, pass along my habits, my effort, the way that I work, the way that I study, to not just the D-line room, but defensively, offensively, to younger guys around, that's only going to improve our football team. And I think it all comes back to, you know, that dream that we talked about at the beginning of the interview. You know, have I exhausted myself in pursuit of that dream? It's still out there. So I'm going to keep clawing. I'm going to keep chasing. And, you know, and I know for a lot of people, players that were much better players than I have, they never really fulfilled that. So, you know, they're not going to get enough other opportunity to come back. So when I get my opportunities, I'm going to give it my best shot.
So exactly what you're talking about when you talk about exhausting yourself in pursuit. Kyle Williams, 5-time Pro Bowler, all-time Bills great. Kyle, so good to get caught up. I appreciate you as always, and I appreciate the relationship. Thank you for the interview.
Jim, good to talk to you, my friend. Have a good one.
Hey, Jim, in that last segment, somebody asked for the return of the adult alarm. What the heck is that? All right, Tony, I see you working. You know what it is. You know what it is, Tony. You know what the adult alarm is. You're not asking. It's not like you don't know. So as I read that, Hawk is saying, I don't know what that is. I know, Hawk, just like you don't know who Larry Holmes is. Just like you don't know who Muhammad Ali is. The adult alarm. All right, the adult alarm was a rather unfortunate device from back in the day. Reportedly, allegedly, rumoredly, legend, whatever you want to say. Speculation was Michael Jackson had an alarm in his home that went off when parents showed up. Why would there be an alarm for that sort of thing? I have no idea. I don't know if it exists. I want to be so clear about this. I don't know if the adult alarm was a real thing. I don't know if it existed. I mean, why would you want an adult alarm? Only if children were in a space where they shouldn't have been? I don't know. The whole thing is very sordid and very speculative, and I really don't know. But at one time, way back in the day, there was, in fact, an adult alarm that we mocked up on this show in the event that such a thing did exist. And if it did, it may have sounded like this.
Macaulay, get dressed. They're inside the perimeter, Macaulay.
I mean, who was the idiot who voiced that? Certainly not somebody trying to sound like Michael Jackson. And I could have swore whoever did voice that as the alarm, the voice of the alarm, said something to the effect of, they're in. Like, the parents are in. And I could have swore he told some child whose name I could not make out to get out. The perimeter had been violated. Anyway, Tony, that's what that was, and I don't really know what that was, or if, in fact, anything like that ever existed. And you know what, Tony? You knew damn well what it was. Don't use the ATP to get me to play something that you know I will not play. This guy wants it as badly as anybody. Let's find out. Josh, what's up? How are you? Go ahead, Josh. You're on the air. Josh!
You don't like that kind
of thing. Oh, Josh. I guess if you stay on hold every single day for 3 hours, and then one day out of the blue, without any warning whatsoever, I go to you early in hour number two, you probably wouldn't be ready. Bad news, Josh. Back to the end of the line. Dude. Josh. I mean, you were on hold literally 2 months to get on the air with that. And I went to you and you weren't there. And now you'll frantically call back. Oh, right where I am. I'm ready. My man, you might be ready now, but you sure as hell weren't ready when I came to you. Back to the end of the line. Hey, Alvin, rack him.
Good night now.